fresh crisis. The firefighters in Memphis were on strike. Another strike. The post-war labor unrest roiling the rest of the nation hit Tennessee, too. Though the unions and the Wobblies weren't as strong here as in other states, they still managed to cause trouble. Roberts had already faced a shoe manufacturing strike in Nashville and a street railway workers' strike in Knoxville. He'd clamped down quickly. You couldn't let them think the governor was a weakling, calling up the Tennessee National Guard and creating a state police force to squelch strikers. He tried to swing public opinion against strikers, mobs, and all others who wanted to hurt the state's reputation and economy by encouraging citizen law and order leagues. The labor people were furious with him, denounced him for setting the classes against the masses, and were out for revenge. Now the firemen in Memphis had walked off the job, demanding better pay. Nashville and Knoxville sent some of their men to take up the hoses, but they were being met with a rash of arson fires, false alarms, and some violence. The Memphis mayor was in a panic, reporting that the situation in the city was extremely grave, and he begged for more militia troops. Roberts was sending them in, and all these women could think about was their suffrage amendment. Roberts hadn't had it easy since his term began just 19 months before. No sooner had he taken his oath than the Spanish flu ripped through the state on a second swing. Then, with the war and its lucrative contracts ended, the war industry plants, such as the DuPont gunpowder plant in Nashville, that at its peak employed 20,000 men and women, closed down, throwing thousands of people out of work, just as inflation ramped up. The returning troops couldn't find jobs, and resented the black men who had taken their jobs. And the black men who had served in the military returned expecting better jobs as a proper reward. It made for friction. Race riots tore through Knoxville in the summer of 1919. White mobs marauding through the black precincts, burning and looting, storming a jail to lynch a black man. Roberts called out the Tennessee National Guard, but they couldn't control the violence and sided with the white rioters, shooting machine guns into the black crowds. About 40 people, mostly blacks, were killed. In the tense atmosphere, the Ku Klux Klan was finding eager new recruits and enjoying a resurgence. Roberts's first act as governor was to certify Tennessee's ratification of the 18th Amendment, Prohibition. It had gone into effect earlier in 1920, and the heavy-handed federal raids were riling up people. Tennessee had been officially dry since 1909, but it had its own ways of handling it, and everyone sort of understood the rules. Memphis and Nashville simply ignored them and remained happily, defiantly wet. Roberts didn't like the federal agents snooping around, arresting and shooting people, but it was out of his hands. Roberts was short, with a small paunch around his belly, big ears, bushy brows, and an unruly forelock curl that he attempted to plaster down each morning. He vaguely resembled the popular humorist Will Rogers, except he wasn't good at telling jokes and rarely cracked a smile in public. He was a serious, earnest man with a milquetoast personality, a teacher turned lawyer, a circuit-riding judge turned hapless politician. He had good intentions, but he couldn't execute his ideas smoothly or get people to understand. He did not seem to have a gift for politics. He did seem to have an uncanny gift for attracting political enemies. Roberts thought of himself as a progressive politician, and he wanted Tennessee to make strides, lead the South. What the state needed was better education and better roads, paid for by fairer taxes. Everyone nodded in agreement, but no one wanted to pay. He set about overhauling the antiquated tax code, and caught hell on all sides. He tried to push through road-building bills and earned the enmity of the railroad owners, who correctly saw automobiles as competition. Tennessee ranked toward the very bottom of the states when it came to literacy, and Roberts wanted to change that by extending mandatory schooling to the 8th grade and improving teacher training. He expected to win some applause for this, but the clapping wasn't loud enough to drown out the boos from the manufacturers, who thought children should be working, not wasting time in school. Roberts was unpopular, and his enemies smelled blood. He could accept the animosity of those who opposed the policy changes he'd made, but he got riled by the naked opportunism of those in his own party who wanted to derail his career for their personal advantage. Luke Lee wanted him out of contention down the road. That was the reason the Tennessean and Lee's people were pounding him. They put up a candidate to run against him in the primary, the former mayor of Chattanooga, Colonel William Crabtree, just for spite. And they began this despicable rumor campaign about his private secretary, about how she was disreputable just because she was pretty. She was very well qualified, and besides, it was none of their business. Albert Roberts was in a desperate fight to hold on to his job, and perhaps his marriage. On top of all this came the 19th Amendment. Roberts had hoped the amendment circus would never roll into town. His dream to dodge the whole mess at first seemed a sure thing. The Tennessee Constitution prohibited a sitting legislature from acting on a federal constitutional amendment. The legislature had to be elected after the amendment was passed by Congress and brought to the states for ratification. This provision was to ensure that constituents would know where their legislators stood on that amendment and could take their stance into consideration in the next election. The provision was placed into the state constitution in 1870, after the Reconstruction legislature and a radical Republican governor had rammed through ratification of the 14th Amendment, giving black men civil rights and due process while disenfranchising the sons of the Confederacy over the objection of the people, the white people of the state. Tennessee did not want a repeat of that. So the present legislature, the 61st General Assembly elected in 1918, was legally prohibited from acting on the 19th Amendment. Roberts was greatly relieved. As he told Mrs. Catt in June 1919, when the ratification process first began and she pressed him to act, sorry, he simply couldn't call an extraordinary session to ratify. His hands were tied. Exactly a year later, he clung to the same excuse when a delegation of Tennessee suffragists marched into his office to convince him to call a special session. Then the U.S. Supreme Court pulled the rug out from under him. On June 1, 1920, the court ruled that the process for ratifying a federal constitutional amendment could not be impeded by any state law or action. Ohio law provided for a popular referendum after legislative ratification of any federal amendment, but the Supreme Court held that this could not stand. The ratification process was clearly spelled out in the federal constitution, which said it was to be done by the state legislature. That took precedence over state law. Roberts's careful avoidance of the 19th Amendment ended abruptly on June 23rd with a telegram from the White House. It would be a real service to the party and to the nation if it is possible for you, under the peculiar provisions of your state constitution, having in mind the recent decision of the Supreme Court in the Ohio case, to call a special session of the legislature of Tennessee to consider the suffrage amendment. Allow me to urge this very earnestly. Woodrow Wilson. Roberts was certain that his hero, fellow Southerner Woodrow Wilson, would not have written this of his own accord. It must have been drafted under pressure from the suffragists, who were salivating at the notion that Tennessee might be in play for ratification. They'd managed to stick their hat pins into the president. Roberts was right about that. To fortify his request, President Wilson also asked the U.S. Department of Justice for an opinion on the applicability of the Supreme Court ruling to Tennessee. Luckily, thought Roberts, Acting Attorney General William L. Frierson, holding down the fort while his boss, Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, was away in San Francisco trying to get himself nominated for president, was a good Tennessean who would surely respect the sanctity of his home state's constitution. Frierson produced an opinion that did not please Governor Roberts. The Supreme Court ruling did indeed apply to Tennessee. If the people of a state, through their constitution, can delay action on an amendment until after an election, there is no reason why they cannot delay it until after 2 elections or 5 elections, Frierson held. And this ran counter to the federal constitution's clear amending procedure. the current Tennessee legislature was free to vote on the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Governor Roberts lost his good excuse. Now Roberts was squeezed all around. The Tennessee suffragists screamed for him to immediately call a special session of the legislature. The Democrats at their convention in San Francisco adopted a special platform plank pointed right at him, demanding that he convene the legislature and achieve ratification quickly. He was pelted with telegrams and phone calls from all the party top brass, from all the prospective presidential candidates, there must have been 24 of them, and, most painfully, from his own Tennessee delegation, men and women at the convention. The president, the man he'd once called his Moses, was urging him, very earnestly, to jump off a cliff. Roberts's advisors and friends counseled, just as earnestly, don't do it. The federal amendment, they warned, is a hydra-headed monster capable of swallowing you and your career. People won't read the legal opinions. They'll just remember that Governor Roberts was willing to go along with the idea that the Tennessee Constitution plays second fiddle to Washington's Constitution. Don't mess with the antis, many of whom were his friends and supporters. If he did call a special session, they threatened to undermine his bid for renomination in the primary, leave him stranded. So Roberts did the safest thing he could think of. He stalled. But he was undercut by the state attorney general's opinion, stating that the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling applied to Tennessee, and there was no longer any legal barrier to calling a special session. Feeling cornered, Roberts announced that he would agree to call an extraordinary session of the legislature, but he wouldn't say exactly when that session would meet. He was buying time, giving the matter his grave consideration, but if he thought the maneuver would buy him any peace, he was fooling himself. The White House went public with its disappointment in Roberts's refusal to speedily call the special session, and the headline in the Nashville Tennessean read, "Administration aggravated by Roberts' stand." The Democrats, still tied in knots in San Francisco, seemed to delight in using him as a punching bag, perhaps the only thing they could agree upon, insisting that he name a firm date for the special session so they might announce it at the convention and take credit for rounding up the 36th state. The Democrats were trying to improve their party's image among potential women voters. Republicans had a much stronger record of supporting suffrage in Congress, as well as in the states. Republican-led legislatures had delivered 26 of the 35 ratifications thus far. Many national suffrage leaders considered themselves Republican, as that party had championed progressive social and economic reforms. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the Republican Party was considered the more liberal of the two major parties. Both Democrats and Republicans had endorsed ratification of the 19th Amendment at their conventions earlier that summer, and so had both state parties in Tennessee. All the gubernatorial candidates running in the state primary claimed to support the amendment, and Roberts's Democratic challenger, Colonel Crabtree, warned that Roberts's indecision was bad for the state. Quote, "Some Republican state will ratify and rob Tennessee of its chance for glory," unquote. The Tennessee suffragists of both parties squawked at him to convene the legislature at once, to get the amendment ratified in time for them and the women of other states to vote in the summer primaries. But women were not good for him, his campaign advisors reminded him. If the women could vote, they might well defeat him. Giving them the ballot would be like handing them a shotgun and inviting them to shoot. They no doubt remembered he'd campaigned for governor as an anti and had equivocated on the partial suffrage bill. And then there were those rumors about an other woman. Keep them away from the primary and, ideally, away from the general election, his friends advised. Tennessee women could already vote for president and for mayors. They already had more than enough suffrage. There were other reasons to be wary of giving women the vote in all elections, including state elections, his advisors warned. The state's major corporate interests didn't like the idea one bit. How could the railroads, just emerging from wartime federal control, successfully compete with the automobile and the truck, and recover all those state dollars being siphoned off into road building, if the legislators with whom they'd already curried favor were defeated by women voters who didn't understand how things worked? And how could the once profitable liquor industry, reeling under the new Volstead Act enforcing the federal prohibition law, survive? They'd managed to keep going for a decade under the lax, wink-wink implementation of Tennessee's own dry laws, but now federal agents were shooting to kill small-time moonshiners operating stills in the Tennessee hills. The big distillers had already moved out of state. Jack Daniels was operating out of Alabama and Missouri, pinching tax revenues from a lucrative business. The only hope for the industry was to finance the election of wetter congressmen and state legislators who might be able to dial back or even wipe out the punitive prohibition enforcement laws. The problem with women voters was that they tended to support temperance and probably would not cast ballots for the types of lawmakers the industry needed. And the manufacturers, especially the state's cotton cloth mills and clothing makers, were also angry about women's suffrage. They were worried about reform-type women voters insisting upon labor laws that would limit the hours women could work, calling for equal pay, and, worst of all, perhaps outlawing child labor. The entire cotton manufacturing economy of the South was based upon the cheap labor of women and children. Was Governor Roberts willing to destroy it for the promise of a few women's votes? And oh yes, Roberts' advisors warned, all those Negro women who would suddenly be able to vote if Tennessee ratified the federal amendment, they were going to vote Republican. Feeling cornered, on June 28th, Roberts finally announced that the extraordinary session would convene on August 9th, safely after his primary. The suffragists howled, but had to accept it. He reminded them, not too subtly, that if he did not win renomination, the special session might not take place at all, in what would be his lame duck misery. His friends in the legislature could hardly be expected to support ratification if he was defeated. To shield himself, he would name his own ratification committee, headed by a suffrage woman he could trust, Mrs. Kate Birch Warner, not the League of Women Voters leaders, Mrs. Kenny and Mrs. Milton, who were his active antagonists. Mrs. Kenny was Luke Lee's little protege, and Mrs. Milton's husband, George, gleefully ripped Roberts apart in the pages of his Chattanooga News. He would not entrust the dangerous ratification campaign to his enemies. Roberts was still on the road when Mrs. Catt arrived, and was in no mood to placate the suffragists today. They were causing him nothing but headaches. He pulled on his jacket. The time had come to meet with Mrs. Catt. He knew what she wanted. It was a short walk from the governor's mansion to the Hotel Hermitage, and Governor Roberts intended to make it a very short visit. He had an early campaign whistle stop scheduled in the morning. The guests were gone, and Catherine Kenny had carefully excused herself to return home and avoid bumping into the governor. Carrie greeted Roberts at the door to her suite, cordially, with a smile and rather friendly manner, but she made it clear this was no sweet tea social occasion. They adjourned to the little office set up next to her bedroom, to speak privately. She looked almost grandmotherly, with her smoothed and carefully pinned gray hair, but her eyes were intense, her mouth firm, like no grandmother he knew. They were, in fact, two politicians making a deal. Governor Roberts wasn't accustomed to negotiating political deals with ladies. It made him uncomfortable. And more malleable. Look, he told Mrs. Catt, as he had already written to her last week, how can you expect me to allow my political enemies to steer an official ratification committee? That is tantamount to suicide for me and defeat for you, he insisted. The 19th Amendment cannot be ratified without the support of my political friends to steer it through the legislature, and they will not abide Mrs. Milton and her husband, and Mrs. Kenny and her friend Luke Lee, all of whom have been maliciously attacking me. Why not have them all simply work under the committee I created, under Mrs. Warner? Kenny and Milton had already told her they would not work under Warner. They didn't trust her political judgment or skill. It was the feuds again. So that solution was not going to fly. And Kat, as National Association president, could not let her Tennessee affiliate be snubbed and superseded. Well then, Mrs. Kat offered, why not have several ratification committees? Lots of committees, the more the merrier. All working toward the same goal, but not necessarily together. A governor's committee, a men's committee, a League of Women Voters committee, a Democratic committee, a Republican committee. Greater involvement, less friction. Though coordinating them all would be a bear, she knew. Politics was a game of fear and favors, and Kat decided this was the moment to spring both upon the governor. He could not afford to alienate his president, his party, and his Tennessee women any longer with this sort of procrastination and manipulation, she insisted. His rival in the primary and the general election would be able to take good advantage of it. His party and his own career would certainly suffer in the fall. And then she held out her most valuable piece of currency. She had done him a great favor today, she could tell him. She had convinced Luke Lee to quash the rabid satire piece in the Nashville Tennessean. But the deal would hold only if Roberts agreed to remove the satire's tempting target and accept the legitimacy of other ratification committees beyond his own. She had rescued the governor's exposed hide, not to mention his fragile ego, from the fire. Now, he owed her. The additional ratification committees were suddenly acceptable to Governor Roberts. He bade Mrs. Kat goodbye and hurried out to catch his train. Kat had seen clearly today that the Tennessee Suffs simply did not have the tactical know-how or breadth of experience to face a fortified opposition on multiple fronts. And she couldn't allow Alice Paul and her Woman's Party people, who would no doubt be coming into the state, to take any credit for winning Tennessee, should the Suffs somehow manage to pull it off. The chief called the hotel switchboard to send a night telegram to the national headquarters in New York. Tennessee promising. Must stay indefinitely. Address, Hermitage Hotel, Suite 309. Chapter 7. The Blessing. Woodrow Wilson awoke, agitated from another bad night of nightmares. In his bedroom, in the second-floor private quarters of the White House, his valet, Brooks, and his wife, Edith, helped him to dress, pulling a starched white shirt over his listless left arm. Washington, like Nashville, was gripped by a heat wave, and the air was already sultry, but Edith draped a shawl over her husband's left side so the visitors would not be able to see that he was paralyzed. She'd managed to keep the extent of his stroke secret for months, and there was no good reason for the men calling on him this morning to learn any more than they needed to know. She wheeled the President of the United States onto the south veranda. Several blocks away, Democratic presidential and vice presidential nominees James Cox and Franklin Roosevelt tied Windsor knots onto their collars, determined to look their best even in this wilting weather, when they met with President Wilson at the White House. They were seeking his blessing. Woodrow Wilson wasn't at all sure he wanted to bestow that blessing, even if it was just a formality, the patriarch of the Democratic Party laying hands upon his hopeful successors. Wilson didn't want successors. He wanted a third term. And he'd even tried to get himself renominated at the party convention in San Francisco a few weeks before. Wilson's doctor, his closest aides, and his wife knew this was delusional, that he was neither physically nor mentally capable of handling another campaign, much less another term. But they dared not confront him lest he plunge into an even deeper depression. The president who had just led his country through a world-shattering war was a very fragile man. The strain of conducting the war was compounded by the stress of negotiating the peace at Paris, then intensified by the frustrations of trying to sell the Treaty of Versailles and his League of Nations concept to the American public, over the heads of what he called the little group of willful men in the Senate who stood in his way. He'd been confident that if the American people could be made to understand that joining the League would not relinquish the nation's autonomy, but build the foundation for lasting peace, they would demand that Congress accept the treaty. Wilson insisted on going out on the road to convince the public himself, a grueling, month-long cross-country rail tour with dozens of rallies and speeches. His doctor believed such a tour might kill him. Wilson was already suffering from fatigue, severe asthma, and occasional cerebral incidents. But Wilson insisted. As commander-in-chief, he'd sent American doughboys into the trenches of Europe, promising them it was the war to end all wars. He felt he must make good on his end of the bargain, make whatever sacrifice was necessary, even his health, to secure the treaty and prevent the world from sliding into war again. In early September 1919, Wilson and his wife set off on the presidential railroad car, the Mayflower, on their own mission to sell the treaty to America. Wilson tipped his straw boater hat in parades, gave speeches defending the League in armories, coliseums, and fairgrounds across the nation. Between stops, he spoke to cheering crowds from the back of the Mayflower's bunting-festooned caboose. But Wilson suffered blinding headaches and breathing attacks almost every night. He was trembling and coughing. His physician, Dr. Carrie Grayson, also on board, grew alarmed. 3 weeks out, in late September, as the tour steered east, steaming through Colorado on its homeward journey, the president seemed confused, tripping on a step, pausing in the middle of his speech, jumbling his words. The pain in his head worsened in the night en route to Wichita, and by morning his left leg and arm had gone numb. Dr. Grayson finally intervened. The rest of the tour must be canceled. The Mayflower rushed back to Washington. 3 nights later, Wilson suffered a second, more severe cerebral embolism in the White House, where Edith found him unconscious on the bathroom floor. He was carried to the Lincoln bed, where he looked dead, recalled one close aide. The doctors were not sure he could pull through. He was paralyzed on his left side, with that side of his face drooping, and his vision and swallowing were impaired. He could still speak, though indistinctly, more like a mumble. His mental functions were not permanently injured, but his psychological state became unsteady, his moods volatile. Since that night in early October 1919, the President of the United States had remained an invalid, but Edith Wilson had taken unprecedented and possibly unconstitutional steps to keep that reality a secret. Wilson's own vice president and cabinet secretaries were kept in the dark about his condition. Press inquiries were rebuffed. Congress was left uninformed. Wild rumors spread, fanned by the White House's obsessive secrecy. The president was simply recovering from nervous exhaustion, according to Dr. Grayson's evasive bulletins. The consulting doctors had told Edith Wilson that any mental strain, any of the usual hard decisions required of a president, would be like turning a knife in an open wound in her husband's weakened condition, undermining any chance for recovery. Her husband's recovery was her singular concern, so she devised a system to keep the White House functioning under her command, or stewardship, as she later dubbed it. Edith, together with Wilson's private secretary, Joseph Tumulty, and Dr. Grayson, became the president's guardians and gatekeepers, and Edith, married to Wilson for only 4 years, became his surrogate. She read every official report, document, and item of correspondence, foreign, domestic, even top secret, and decided whether her husband should be bothered with it or not. If she deemed the matter worthy of his attention, she presented her own précis of it to him, reading her summary out loud and interpreting his response. She devised a set of form letters to notify governmental officials of the president's desired outcomes. Edith was not a complete novice in this sort of sensitive work. During the war, she had helped decipher coded military communiques for her husband, and he confided in her on many policy matters. But as she filtered the world for the president, protecting and isolating him, she assumed what some have called the bedside presidency. Edith knew that Woodrow was still depressed about losing out to James Cox for the presidential nomination earlier in July, and there was great trepidation in the White House this morning about how the president would react to Cox's visit. Democratic candidate James Cox had dashed to Washington directly from his conference with Sue White and Alice Paul in Ohio. He took the midnight train from Columbus and was very pleased upon his arrival in D.C. to read the extensive newspaper coverage of that meeting in the morning papers. As an old newspaper man himself, he'd been a reporter, editor, and publisher, he was impressed by the Woman's Party's ability to generate press attention. Cox promises aid to Suffs, the headlines announced. I give to you without any reservation the assurance that my time, my strength, and my influence will be dedicated to your cause, the papers reported his telling the suffragists, with a view to procuring a favorable result in Tennessee. He promised to do everything in my power to see the federal amendment through. Perhaps he'd been a bit effusive. I find nothing in Holy Writ or elsewhere which shows the Almighty ever gave man the right to say that he could vote and women could not, and gone a bit far in promising to appoint more women to high government positions. But he had a decent record on suffrage in Ohio, even if he stuck to a middle ground, leaning toward the Suffs when it suited him, while able to make the antis think he had an open mind. But many suffragists were still wary of him. There were rumors of corruption, a nasty divorce, and he was thoroughly wet, making Suffs fear that he was enthralled to the liquor interests who were bankrolling the skirmishes against ratification in the states. Cox's enthusiastic response to Paul's delegation was his attempt to allay those fears. He certainly wasn't exaggerating his desire for a Democratic state such as Tennessee to clinch ratification, allowing him to take credit for it during the upcoming campaign. He knew he'd need women's votes as he struggled to overcome Woodrow Wilson's and the Democratic Party's disfavor with the war-weary and even peace-wary American public. Even Carrie Catt was sending encouraging signals to him, as she branded Warren Harding's refusal to push the Republican governors of Vermont and Connecticut to call special sessions unacceptable. It is true that the Republican Party has a record of nearly five times as many ratifications as the Democratic, Catt told reporters. But without the 36th state, that record is like a great tail without a kite. Apparently, it is the Democrats who must supply the kite. Cox knew that Tennessee offered him a shining opportunity to provide that kite and a chance to reset the national map of ratification, giving Democrats a boost. He didn't like poking his nose into another governor's business, and Governor Roberts was certainly in a sticky spot, but he would try his best to gently nudge the governor and the Democratic legislature to sew up ratification of the amendment. Get all those women on board for November, thankful to Democrats. This was Cox's presidential moment, his time to lead the party, and with luck, to lead the nation. And he didn't want anything to spoil it. The Democrats tapped the brash young Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to be Cox's running mate. Roosevelt brought attractive attributes to the ticket that Cox lacked. A famous name, Ivy League connections, buoyant energy, and, in anticipation of at least some women voting in the presidential election, whether or not the federal amendment was ratified in time to give all women the ballot, good looks and gregarious charm. He sure beat the Republican VP candidate, Calvin Coolidge, in that department, the Democratic power brokers chortled. Democrats also hoped he would appeal to woman suffragists, who counted FDR as a dependable friend. He liked to claim that he'd been converted to the cause in 1911, when he was a novice New York State senator, and the sultry suffrage activist Inez Milholland came to his office to lobby him in support of a proposed suffrage amendment to the state constitution. Roosevelt had been ducking the suffrage question, claiming his conservative Hudson Valley district wasn't much for it, so he couldn't commit. The way Roosevelt liked to tell it, Milholland, the suffrage movement's most glamorous crusader, a brilliant Vassar grad with a law degree who was soon to become famous for leading suffrage parades astride a white horse, sat on his desk and dazzled him with her legal and moral arguments for suffrage. She convinced him that suffrage was the only chivalric position for a decent man to hold. Whether or not that was the true or whole story, and his wife Eleanor did not like that version of events, disputing the singular persuasive power of that memorable visit, FDR came out for woman suffrage, and his wife was flabbergasted by his new stance. "I was shocked," she would later confess, "as I had never given the question serious thought, for I took it for granted that men were superior creatures and knew more about politics than women did." Eleanor wasn't violently opposed to woman suffrage, as some biographers have inferred. She'd simply absorbed the women's proper sphere rationale still prevalent in her family and social set. And as the wife of an up-and-coming politician, she didn't think she should have political opinions of her own. Even after New York women won suffrage in 1917, Eleanor did not exercise her franchise, declining to accompany Franklin to the polls at Hyde Park in the fall 1918 elections. Edith Wilson also didn't approve of enfranchising women, and made no bones about it. Her hostility toward the idea of woman suffrage had only hardened as she watched zealous women make spectacles of themselves in the streets, trying to intimidate, to humiliate her husband. She despised those picketers. A stance in favor of women's political equality did not come naturally to Woodrow Wilson either, a Presbyterian minister's son with a conservative Virginian upbringing. Wilson was raised with reverence for the Southern traditions of true womanhood, and he placed his mother, wife, both first and second, and three daughters on proper pedestals. He adored the women in his life and needed them to adore and coddle him. But his women were meant to be comforters and confidants, not colleagues, and not fellow citizens participating in the life of the nation. Wilson was a scholar of American democracy and a hands-on practitioner of the American political system. He served as president of Princeton University and governor of New Jersey at a time when woman suffrage was being hotly debated in intellectual circles and fiercely contested in many state campaigns. But for most of his public career, Woodrow Wilson tried to avoid the issue of women's equal suffrage as best he could. When pressed, he admitted,
"I must say very frankly that my personal judgment is strongly against it. I believe that the social changes it would involve would not justify the gains that would be accomplished by it."
As Wilson eyed a run for the White House in 1912, knowing he needed to attract a broader constituency, including the women of 9 western states who already enjoyed the franchise and could vote in both state and federal elections, he modified his suffrage stance somewhat. Even as Teddy Roosevelt's third-party progressives beat the drum for woman suffrage in the 1912 presidential campaign, Wilson managed to sidestep the issue, saying it wasn't a national matter, but purely a state decision, and not within the purview of a presidential candidate. This placed him in a safe zone with the base of his party, the Southern States' Rights Democrats, who feared a coercive federal amendment. Wilson was confronted by the suffrage question even before he could take his oath of office. If he'd managed to duck the issue in the campaign, Alice Paul, the new director of the National's lobbying department, the Congressional Committee, made sure he could ignore it no longer. To draw attention to the issue, Paul organized a huge suffrage parade through Washington on the day before Wilson's inauguration, March 3, 1913. More than 5,000 marchers from every state, led by Inez Milholland on her white horse, stepped down Pennsylvania Avenue, accompanied by bands and elaborate floats. Carrie Catt and Anna Howard Shaw marched too. Eleanor Roosevelt, in Washington to join the inauguration festivities, her husband had just won a Wilson political appointment, watched the parade go by. The suffrage parade was too funny, she wrote to a friend, and nice fat ladies with bare legs and feet posed in tableaus on the Treasury steps. Washington had never seen anything like it, and some spectators definitely didn't like it. The marchers were attacked by mobs of irate men and boys, outraged by the sight of women demanding their rights in so public a fashion. Women were grabbed off floats, thrown to the ground, their banners pulled from their hands and smashed, their clothes ripped. The police stood by and didn't intervene, leaving the marchers unprotected. Federal troops from a nearby base had to be called in to restore order. The march and the melee made headlines around the country on the day Woodrow Wilson put his hand on the Bible. Within the next months, Wilson was bombarded with pleas, petitions, processions, automobile caravans, and other novel types of agitation, organized by the very insistent Miss Paul, to convince him of the popular demand for woman suffrage and the need for a federal amendment. He responded with a confusing mix of evasion and equivocation. Ever the astute politician, even while he dissembled, Wilson kept track of the shifting political winds and the changing popular attitudes on the woman suffrage question. Even when state suffrage referenda were defeated, the number of I-ballots cast by men was growing larger. The number of senators and representatives sent to Washington by suffrage states, and so answerable to both men and women voters, made up a small but not insignificant proportion of the Congress. The number of women whose states allowed them presidential suffrage, who could vote for or against him in the 1916 election, was nothing to sneeze at. But still, he waffled. Wilson believed that suffrage for women would be a disaster for the American home, and he was determined to defend men's castles. His own home was mostly a happy one. His first wife, the sweet and selfless Ellen, doted on her husband. She was a Southern social conservative who saw no need for women to tromp into a polling booth to vote for her husband or anyone else. The Wilsons allowed their daughters to go off to college, though the girls had to convince their mother that higher education would not make them unfeminine. When Ellen died in the middle of Woodrow's first term, he was bereft and despondent. But just 6 months after Ellen's death, he became smitten with a beautiful and vivacious widow, Edith Bowling Gault. He proposed to her within weeks of first setting eyes on her. His aides worried that the public would think it unseemly for him to marry so soon after Ellen's death, and voters, especially those Western women who had the vote, might punish him when he ran for re-election. Wilson announced his engagement to Edith in early October 1915, and on the very same day declared his intention to travel home to Princeton to cast his ballot in favor of woman suffrage in the New Jersey referendum later that month. I believe that the time has come to extend that privilege and responsibility to the women of the state, he declared, emphasizing that he was voting not as the leader of his party or as the leader of the nation, but as a private citizen who believed that woman suffrage was a matter to be decided by each state, not foisted on them by Congress. Wilson knew the New Jersey referendum was safely doomed, but the move was symbolic, part of his re-election strategy to win back disaffected progressive voters who'd been alienated by some of his first-term decisions, including imposing racial segregation in the federal civil service, while mollifying those Western women voters and winning points with Eastern suffragists. And this new suffrage stance might even protect him from any negative fallout from his remarriage. Carrie Catt, then leader of the Empire State campaign to win the franchise for New York women in the same 1915 election, immediately sent a telegram of thanks to the president. On behalf of a million women in New York State who have declared they want the ballot, please accept my gratitude for your announcement that you will vote for the woman suffamend in New Jersey. She hoped Wilson's coattails might extend across the Hudson and help her win the New York referendum. His coattails were threadbare. The male voters of both states, as well as those in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, voted woman suffrage down. Alice Paul, now leader of a breakaway suffrage organization, the Congressional Union for Woman Suffrage, which would later be renamed the National Woman's Party, was much less impressed with the president's intentions. With his pledge to vote in New Jersey, he also repudiated the federal amendment in favor of a doomed state-by-state approach. Paul intended to hold Wilson and all Democrats responsible for the failure of the federal suffrage amendment to progress one inch in Congress during his first term. She announced the Congressional Union would actively campaign against Wilson's re-election in the Western suffrage states and against the re-election of all Democratic congressmen and senators, whether or not they supported woman suffrage. Paul and her followers would punish the party in power, just as her mentor Mrs. Pankhurst had done in England. It was a promise she intended to keep. With the White House announcement that the president was remarrying and voting for woman suffrage, the press took the coincidence of the two statements as evidence that the soon-to-be new Mrs. Wilson had transformed the president into a suff. "The joke is that she's against it," Carrie Grayson reported to a friend, "but she's too good a diplomat to say anything on the subject these days." Edith Bowling Gault was certainly no suff. Like Woodrow, she was a proud Virginian, claiming to be a direct descendant of Pocahontas. Her grandparents owned slaves. She was clever and opinionated, though she admitted she'd paid no attention to national or political affairs until she met Woodrow. A stickler for propriety, the tall, blue-eyed widow had definite ideas about a woman's proper role. It was to cherish and support her husband. But she had no problem assuming control of her late husband's lucrative jewelry business, and no qualms about showing off her independence and driving prowess as the first woman to hold a driver's license in the District of Columbia, zipping around town in her own open-top electric car. Wilson married Edith on December 18, 1915, in a private ceremony at her Washington townhouse. Just blocks away at the Willard Hotel, the suffragists of the National American Woman Suffrage Association were celebrating the election of Carrie Catt as their new president, drafted, she might say dragooned, into leadership once again, at a time of crisis for the movement. The day after the wedding, as the president and his bride embarked on their honeymoon, two of their wedding guests, the president's daughter Margaret and his cousin Helen Woodrow Bones, who had stepped in as official White House hostess when Ellen died, sat on the stage with Carrie Catt, in places of honor, at the National Association's convention rally. And in a basement office on F Street, Alice Paul, Lucy Burns, and the officers of the Congressional Union, their split with the National having been made final during that week's convention, sketched their plans to go their separate way, maneuver around Carrie Catt and the suffrage establishment, and defeat Woodrow Wilson. Along with an expensive trousseau, Edith brought her antipathy toward woman suffrage to the White House, so it was painful for her to sit through her husband's effort to woo the women of the National Association during his re-election campaign in the summer of 1916. While Alice Paul and her followers were campaigning against Wilson, Carrie Catt saw Wilson as a potential, persuadable ally. She invited the president to address a special National Association conference in Atlantic City. The president was escorted to the podium by his wife on one side and Carrie Catt on the other, walking through an honor guard of besashed suffs from every state, purposely selected for their beauty. Among them was Tennessee suffragist Ann Dudley. Edith sat on the podium, a lovely being to look at, as one attendee described her, and as remote, as detached from that scene as if she had come from another world. As she sat there, her small feet crossed, an invisible line seemed to separate her from all these women. They knew without her having said it that she did not sympathize with them. Edith's distaste for suffrage grew only deeper as Alice Paul's followers, now organized into the National Woman's Party, intensified their attacks on her precious one, making them more personal and bitter. When they began picketing the White House in January 1917, with placards imploring, "Mr. President, how long must we wait for liberty?" Edith began calling them disgusting creatures. During the war, when those placards lambasted her husband as Kaiser Wilson, she railed against those detestable suffragists. When the picketers were arrested for obstructing the sidewalk and thrown into jail, abused and force-fed, Edith dismissed them as those demons in the workhouse. She questioned her husband's decision to pardon suffrage prisoners in July 1917, a move intended to get the news of their ill-treatment off the front page. Edith wanted the suffrage protesters who'd taunted and embarrassed her husband to serve their time in jail, be taught a proper lesson. But Edith also witnessed, at close hand, from her favorite window seat in the southwest corner of the White House, how the war altered the national landscape in so many ways, changed circumstances, changed minds, eventually changed her husband into an advocate for the federal amendment. During the war, as Wilson slowly, hesitantly made that swing to embrace the amendment, Edith could sense the political forces pressing upon him, the attitudinal shifts he was forced to accommodate. America had a new role in the world, as both the beacon and the guardian of democracy. And Edith also recognized that an element of his change of mind was the debt Woodrow owed to Mrs. Catt, a debt he was honor-bound to repay. Mrs. Catt had not sent her National Association women to picket the White House, nor did she intervene on behalf of Paul when the young zealot called herself a political prisoner. Most important, Mrs. Catt had helped Woodrow to wage and win the war, bringing the women of America, even the suffragists, to his side. That had been the most wrenching and most controversial decision of her entire life. Carrie Catt, the confirmed pacifist, founding member of the Woman's Peace Party, had come around to accepting America's entry into the war. And even more significant, she had pledged the loyalty and assistance of the 2 million women affiliated with the National for whatever war work was needed. It was the gamble of an astute, if agonized, suffrage politician. She'd watched her International Woman Suffrage Alliance comrades go through the same torment. When the United Kingdom went to war 3 years before, all the British suffragists, mainstream and militant, even the Pankhursts, had put aside their demands for the vote to devote themselves to war work. "What's the use of having a vote if there's no country to vote in?" Emmeline Pankhurst famously explained. Catt called an emergency meeting of the National Association's Executive Council, and after tearful debate, they approved her suggested policy, calling for suffragists to work simultaneously for the war and for the vote, allowing members to do their war work under the national banner and prove suffragists' patriotism. Catt paid a steep personal price for her decision. She was booted out of the Woman's Peace Party and shunned by her fellow pacifists, who felt she had deserted them. She'd made a Faustian bargain with Woodrow Wilson, they complained. She had bartered her principles for uncertain political gain. She had become a patsy for the warmongers and profiteers. She took the blows silently, but vowed that once suffrage was won, she would devote herself to peace and disarmament work for the rest of her life. But when Woodrow Wilson helped to round up the last votes needed for the amendment's passage in the House of Representatives in January 1918, Carrie Catt could, and did, take credit for patiently, skillfully bringing the president around. Just as she'd calculated, American women, by their loyalty and deeds, had earned the vote in the eyes of the president. Alice Paul would insist that credit for the turnaround belonged to her brave, defiant picketers and prisoners, who'd shamed Congress and the president into acknowledging that democracy needed to begin at home. They were both right. From that time on, Woodrow Wilson never refused Carrie Catt's appeals for help. "My dear Mrs. Catt," was his salutation in his notes to her. Even if he could not manage, or as some said, did not try hard enough to fulfill her requests, twist the right arms, translate his pledges into action, he always promised her he would try. And when the amendment remained stuck in the Senate in September 1918, Cat prevailed upon Wilson to make a direct appeal in the Senate chamber. Wilson made the argument that woman suffrage was a spiritual instrument he needed, vital to the winning of the war. Women deserved the franchise. There was no longer any question.
"We have made partners of the women in this war. Shall we admit them only to a partnership of suffering and sacrifice and toil, and not to a partnership of privilege and right?"
The senators took huffy offense. No president had ever made a personal appearance in their chamber to push for legislation, and they ignored Wilson's entreaties. The very next day, the Senate humiliated him by rejecting the amendment again, 2 Democratic votes shy of passage. President Wilson fell ill just when Carrie Catt needed him most. She'd been counting on his help during the fall of 1919 to secure ratification of the amendment in states where governors or legislatures were being stubborn or slow, where a note or call from the White House might do the trick. Like the rest of the country, she didn't know how sick the president really was. Nor did she realize that her pleas for help were probably being routed through Mrs. Wilson. She was saved by White House Secretary Joseph Tumulty, a suffragist, who did his best to take Cat's missives directly to the president when he could, sidestepping Mrs. Wilson, or even handling the matter himself, as he assumed the task of writing many of the president's more routine statements and letters. So Cat's requests for presidential letters were faithfully dispatched, and that telegram urging Governor Roberts to convene a special session in Tennessee was put through promptly. But if President Wilson considered the ratification of the 19th Amendment and the enfranchisement of American women to be a significant part of his legacy, it was not part of the discussion with his political heirs. After their hour with the president, Cox and Roosevelt walked to the executive wing of the White House, where Cox put his newspaperman's skills to good use, quickly jotting down a statement for release to the press. "From every viewpoint, the meeting was delightful," Cox scribbled. "I found the president in splendid shape, and I was most agreeably surprised by his condition," he lied to the 60 journalists gathered for an impromptu press conference. After lunch with the candidates and Edith, Tumulty, and Grayson, Wilson dictated his own press statement to his stenographer. "Governor Cox and I were absolutely at one on the great issue of the League of Nations." Unity was the theme of the day. There was no mention of enfranchisement, nothing about ratification, nor was there any strategic discussion of the prospect of 27 million women headed to the polls in November. Or not. Carrie Catt feared she knew why. There were what she called sinister forces at work. There might be no tail and no kite. Chapter 8. On Account of Sex. Carrie Catt did not bring her sapphire blue battlefield uniform, her ratification dress, to Nashville. It was the dress she'd ordered to celebrate passage of the federal suffrage amendment in the U.S. House of Representatives in early 1918. That blue dress was Cat's sartorial symbol of the amendment, her shout of confidence in the ultimate, however maddeningly delayed, triumph of the cause. In one of those odd quirks of fate, the federal amendment began to be forged on the very day that young Carrie had awakened to the woman suffrage issue. On Election Day morning, 1872, when Carrie first felt the slap of political exclusion in her mother's kitchen, she didn't know that at that very moment, hundreds of other women were also pounding on the closed doors of the American polling place. That same morning in Rochester, New York, Susan Anthony calmly walked into her local polling place and broke the law by dropping a paper ballot into a wooden box. She brought along her three sisters and about a dozen of her local suffrage club friends. The election registrars weren't sure what to do. She convinced them that voting was women's legal right as citizens, The women were permitted to cast their ballots. "Well, I have been and gone and done it," Anthony gleefully wrote to her suffrage collaborator, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. "Positively voted the Republican ticket, straight this a.m. at 7 o'clock, and swore my vote in at that." Anthony was experimenting with a new legal strategy to win the vote, a concept called the New Departure,